I just want to mention, you know, on Shabbos we read Parshas Chukas, which of course is the mystery of the Parah Aduma. And going to the week before that, which was Parshas Korach, we read that Korach was cholek on Moshe Rabbeinu. And there's a medrash that says that Ma Ra Korach lachlok al Moshe. What was the thing that made Korach argue with Moshe? So the medrash answers it was Parah Aduma Ra. He saw the Parah Aduma, and therefore he was cholek on Moshe. Right? So somehow, the concept of Parah Aduma was gorein, that there was a machlokas between Korach and Moshe. Now, how is that so? So the emesis, the Mefarshim say that Parah Aduma, which of course is called the Chok, the most mysterious of all halachas, even Shlomo HaMelech didn't know the reason. That's why it's called a Chok. Chok means something for which you don't know a reason. But Korach was able to understand the reason of even Parah Aduma. That's how great he was. He understood Parah Aduma. Korach, yeah. Korach. And as a result, it was...
Not Moshe, only Korach.
Yeah, that's the thing. Korach's ability to understand Parah Aduma was, again, I mean, Rashi himself points out that Korach had a lot of reasons why he thought he was greater than Moshe. Remember, Korach's descendant was Shmuel HaNavi, and Shmuel is considered to be Shokol. Shokol means equal, Keneged, Moshe, and Aaron, as it says in Tehillim, Moshe, the Aharon, B'chol HaNav. Moshe and Aaron are Hashem's Kohanim. Shmuel, B'korei Shmo. So Korach figured like this. Korach figured, if my Yichus, I have a Shmuel coming from me, then I must be pretty good, right? As the Yiddish say, the apple doesn't go far from the tree. And indeed, in this level, Korach had a deeper level of Havana, even greater than Moshe. An amazing thing. Korach was Nichshon, because Korach had a level of Havana that was phenomenally deep and perceptive. And that, of course, leads a person astray. The Ari says the following. The Ari says an amazing thought. The Ari says that take the gematria of Korach. Korach is Kuf Reish Ches. That's 248. Take the gematria of Moshe. Moshe is what? 345. So the Ari says Moshe adds up to Korach plus Hevel. Now, what's Korach? Korach is 248, and Hevel is 37, right? So 248 and 37 equals 345. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm adding up my numbers wrong. One second. Korach is 348. Yeah. 1 second. Why am I having trouble? 308. I'm sorry. Korach is 308. Yeah. Korach is 308. Moshe is 345. Hevel is 37. So if you add Korach plus Hevel, you get Moshe. Korach plus Hevel equals Moshe. Or to put it in reverse, Korach equals Moshe minus Hevel. This is from the Ari. So what's the significance of this? So the Shem Shmuel says the following. Let's go back to Kayin and Hevel.
Korach equals Moshe minus Hevel?
That's correct. Because Moshe is 345 and Hevel is 37. So 345 minus 37 is 308. And you could say it two ways. It's the same thing. It's you could say Korach plus Hevel equals Moshe, or Moshe minus Hevel equals Korach. Now, or you could say Moshe minus Korach equals Hevel. It all comes up the same. You'll see the connection with this. The Shem Shmuel says like this. He says, let's go back to Bryas HaOlam, when you have Kayin and Hevel. Right? Those are the first two children, as it were, that came into the world. Now, why did Chava call her first child Kayin? She said, Konisi Ish Im Hashem. The English translation is, I have acquired a man with God. Now, the English translation suggests, who is the Ish, in other words? Who is the Ish? The Ish seems to be Adam.
Well,
no, you'll see. In other words, I'm just asking what... No, but Ish. In other words, If you say I have acquired a man with God, so one possible meaning is similar to what Leah said when she had her children. Now my husband will feel more attached to me because I have created life. Konisi ishes Hashem, I have acquired my husband by virtue of having children.
She's referring to the fact that she has a male child.
I'm giving different explanations. So according to one explanation, the object ish is her husband, Adam Harishon. Just like Leah says when she has Levi, Hapam Yilove Ishi, my husband shall stay with me now. Of course, one could argue, Leah had to say that because there was competition, there were other wives, in effect, who would Adam go to. But still, she's making the point that the creation of life through Hashem has brought us closer than we would otherwise be. However, the truth is the word konisi can have two meanings. Konisi can mean acquire something, but konisi can also mean to create something. Where do we see that koneh can mean bore? We see this by Malchitzedek, right after Abraham saves Lot. So it mentions Malchitzedek, the king of Yerushalayim. The king of Shalayim was actually Shem ben Noach. Brings out Lechem v'Yayin, and it says, Baruch Lokel Elyon, blessed is Avraham to the all-exalted God, who is the Konei Shamayim Va'aretz, and Rashi explains, Konei over there means Bore, creator. Because obviously you own something that you create. So if I interpret Konisi Ish Es Hashem, I have created a man with God, then it would appear, although you could still learn the other way, it would appear that the Ish is the child himself, Kayan. In other words, Kayan is, I have created life with God. Of course, you could also say she created her husband and making him a father, but the Pashtus, that explanation would be going on Kayan. So the Shemesh Shmuel says, if we interpret Konisi to mean I have created, now the Ari makes the point in a lot of places that the name that a child is given is considered to be a prophecy about their essential personality. Now, it's not clear how that works. It's not clear to me if the Ari means the name influences the child or the name indicates the personality of the child. In other words, does it influence or does it simply indicate? But be it as it may, the Ari writes that the name that at least a boy is given at a bris, the girl will be given at an aliyah of the Torah, is a nevuah that Hashem put into the parents regarding the personality of the child. That's why you find sometimes at a bris, and I've been at two brises actually, that were the same chash of a person that behaved differently. Sometimes there's a mistake where the moral or whoever's naming the baby doesn't give the child the right name. Now, this is sometimes done on purpose. For example, sometimes you may have a Zaidi or Bub, you know, a grass, who wants a child named after their father, let's say. And instead, the baby's being named after somebody else. So the Zaidi that's naming the baby will sometimes just, you know, pick the name they want. But sometimes it's by accident. Sometimes it's a Shlomo or a Shmuel or a Shol, you know, they didn't hear right. So the question is, if at the Kriyas Hashem they said the wrong name, do you correct it or not? Do you kind of go back? So I was at two brises, really, which were not too far apart, where the same person was the namer. And in one time he said, just change the name. And the other time he said, Mi Hashem Yatzah Hadavar, that since Kriyas Hashem is a getter of Nevuah, if this is the name that came out, then this has to be the name.
Same person,
yeah. It was like two different
names. What was the name?
You know, one was a Shalom instead of a Shlomo. You know, I don't remember. Maybe it was close enough. I don't know exactly what the idea was. Yeah. But there is a concept of Nevuah. The Ari does say that this is Nevuah. A shame is Nevuah. So the Shem Yishmael says, based on this teaching, Kayan represents that capacity within a human being to create, to dominate, to control, to master, to innovate. Now you'll notice in all of these different words that I used, some of them strike us as good things, right? And some of them strike us as bad things. Meaning, it's not right to look at Kayan as, you know, the all bad. Kayan was that aggressive force in the human race in which it is necessary to create. From Kayan, will come the impulse towards, you know, science and discovery and conquest, conquering disease and creating technology. In fact, the Emma says, even in Ruchnius, Kayin was a Mechadesh. How do you see this? An amazing thing, we often don't notice this. Who was the first person to bring the Korban to Hashem? Kayin was Mechadesh, the Inyan of Korban. Hevel improved it. Hevel Lahavdol is like the Japanese. They, like, you take the existing technology and you can do it better and cheaper. Okay? Even the VCR wasn't invented by, it was invented by Americans, but, you know, the German Sony manages to make a cheaper model, a better model. So the pshat is like this. So Kayin was Mechadesh Korbanos, that it brings, in a way we don't understand, a Reach Nicholach Lashem. Hevel improved it by bringing a better thing, by doing it with more Mesiras Nefesh. The Chiddush in Avodas Hashem comes from Kayin. So Kayin is the idea of creativity within the human being. Now, creativity, when it's misdirected, can very easily turn into arrogance and self-sufficiency, when you believe, as it were, that you're the master of the universe. Now, the name Hevel is the opposite Koach, right? Hevel, what is Hevel? We know in Koheles, Shlomo HaMelech always uses, Havel Havolim Amar Koheles. Hevel means vanity or futility. By the way, vanity is a little misleading. You know, the famous biblical translation of the phrase Hevel, Havel Habalim, is vanity of vanities.
Yeah.
But we have to understand that the modern use of the word vanity is not the same as the King James version of the use of vanity. In other words, today we use vanity to be conceit or arrogance. But that's not what vanity used to mean. Vanity used to mean futility. Worthlessness. It was almost the opposite of the idea. So the more accurate modern Havel Havolim is things are futile, ephemeral. What does Hevel mean? Hevel is the breath. When you blow out on a winter day and there's a little bit of fog, and the fog is here 1 second, you wipe it away and it's gone. That's Havel Havolim. Life, in fact, one could even say, it's not even a question of futile, but rather Koheles is bemoaning the fact that life is so short and transience. So Hevel represents that koach within the human being from which comes humility, self-abnegation, a sense of one's worthlessness, or at least, as compared to the Ribbono Shel Olam, one's smallness of spirit. Anava. Now, of course, we understand that the ideal human being needs to incorporate both of these kochos, right? But because we know that the hevel alone leads to a person's worthlessness, a person's sense of futility, a person, as it were, clasping their hands together and saying, you know, what's the use? So one needs that koch of creativity and power, but one also needs to counterbalance it with the hevel.
Why was he named Hevel?
Well, why was he named Tevel? Does the Chumash actually, I'm trying to recall, the Chumash does not give a reason why he was named Tevel. But it seems to be connected to the notion that, although Kayin and Hevel were twins, they're actually born the same day, but it seems to be a reflection of the fact that because death exists in the world, then by definition, all life is Hevel, because all life leads to death. It's almost as if, see, this is the problem with twins. In fact, in the first one, we even say it by Yaakov and Esav, that the problem is, twins are really one person who gets split. Meaning, the ideal human being should have been a composite of Kayin and Hevel. But they split in different ways. And the Ari writes that if Kayin represents the koach of creativity and innovation, and Hevel represents humility and submission, each was incomplete. Because in Kayin's creativity and power, there was arrogance and gaiva. And in Hevel's humility and submission, there was kind of a paralysis of will in which Hevel was unable to be creative in Avodas Hashem. All he could do was imitate. All he could do was ride the coattails of another. Now the Ari has a sefer called Shara Gogulim in which different tzaddikim are considered to be reincarnations of earlier generations. And the Ari writes that Hevel's neshama needed a tikkun, needed to be rectified. And the Gilgal of Hevel was Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu, therefore, is called the Anav Mikol Adam, the humblest of all human beings, because Moshe Rabbeinu is a Gilgal of heaven. But why is it a tikkun?
The reason it's... You would never be the opposite.
No, we wouldn't say the opposite. We're not going to say that the tikkun to excessive anava is to become a Baal Gaiva. We're not going to say that. But rather, what Moshe Rabbeinu did was, in the koach of anava, he was able to assume leadership, give direction, teach Torah, be mechadesh in Torah, be willing to stand up even against the Ribono Shel Olam when it came, not for his own selfish benefit, but when it came to be mispalel for Klal Yisrael. In other words, one recognizes their anava, one recognizes their humility, one recognizes that they are nothing in the eyes of the Ribono Shel Olam, as it were. But one also knows that we have kochos that we have to use, and we have to have the courage to rise to those challenges, and that we have to be HaKadosh Baruch Hu's partners in bringing Kedusha into the world. And that is a tikkun of the Midah of Hevel. So the Shema Shmuel says, based on this, we can now understand the Ari's point, that Korach is Moshe without the attribute of Hevel. And that's the tragedy, you know. Talk about Greek tragedy, we'll have a different things. You know, when we talk about Greek tragedy, the tragedy, which is tragedy, is when one is touched with greatness, but there's a fatal flaw within that destroys all the good that was there. Those that don't have that greatness, in a sense, their fall is not so tragic because there was not that greatness there. Korach had tremendous greatness. Creativity, understanding, Havana, even the depths of the Parah Aduma. But because it was not counterbalanced by the Hevel, by the Anava, as it were, it destroyed him. He was destroyed by jealousy. He was destroyed by seeing at what Moshe was given and what Aaron was given. And because of that jealousy, he did not see what he was given. Right? The real tragedy of jealousy is not merely the jealousy you have to others, it is not seeing godless that a person has within, not seeing, right? Chazal say, every person has a level of malchus. Every person is a melech over something. And a malchus cannot touch another malchus even a hair's breadth. But a person is always looking at the other malchus. A person does not see their malchus. And that's the tremendous tragedy, and that's what the Ari means. The Shema Shmuel says, when Korach is Moshe minus the Hevel, or Moshe is Korach plus the Hevel, because these are the two ideas that a person needs to combine. And again, it comes out, and in fact, this comes out in the connected to the Parah Aduma. This actually comes out in the Parah Aduma as well. The two ideas, the notion of Bishvili Nivra Olam, that because of me the world was created. And the other lesson of Anochi Afor V'Efer, I am dust and I am ashes. This comes out the emphasis in the Parah Aduma as well. You know, the Parah Aduma is described as Zeis Chukas HaTorah. This is the Chok of the Torah. Chok, we know, are the mitzvos that don't have a reason. Well, I shouldn't do it over there. We don't understand their reason. Mishpat are the mitzvos which are logical. So the Mefarshim ask a lot of kashas. They ask, first of all, why does it say Zos Chukas HaTorah? This is the Chok of the Torah. Why don't we say Zos Chukas HaParah? This is the law of the Parah. Why does it say the whole Torah? So there are a lot of explanations that are given. One explanation that's given, the Orach Chaim says, because the whole ritual of Parah Aduma is designed to purify you from Tumas Nes, if one is in contact with the dead. And there is a lesson here that the law, the concept of Tuma is a function of the Kedusha that existed when there was life. Meaning to say, the greater the holiness when there's life, the greater the Tuma when that holiness is evacuated. So, for example, a dead animal conveys tuma, but it's a much less severe level of tuma than a dead human being. If I touch a dead animal, I'm only tummy for one day, and I don't need to be sprinkled with the parah aduma. If I touch a dead human being, I'm tummy 7 days. Now, a dead Jewish corpse conveys more tuma than a dead non-Jewish corpse. If I touch a non-Jewish corpse, I am tummy for 7 days. That's true. But if I'm in the same room with a non-Jewish corpse, I'm not tummy. But a Jewish corpse conveys tuma even in the same room when you're in a cemetery. And this was a mistake the Arabs made. You may recall, if you have been in Eretz Israel, that in back of the Golden Gate, the Shar HaZahav of the, which is the closed off gate, adjacent to the Har HaBayis, facing Har HaZeisim on the other side, right? So you have a valley, but then you have right against the gate, you have an Arab cemetery. And the reason the Arabs have a cemetery there, the Arabs know their Midrashim, and they know that, according to Chazal, Eliyahu HaNavi is going to enter Yerushalayim through the Mount of Olives, down the Nachal Kidron, and up enter into the Golden Gate. They also know that Eliyahu HaNavi is Pinchas, who is a Kohen, and a Kohen, they know, is not allowed to walk through a cemetery. So in their desire to prevent Eliyahu HaNavi coming and redeeming the Har HaBayis or announcing Mashiach, they made a cemetery there, so Eliyahu HaNavi won't be able to go through, and they feel that'll somehow stop Mashiach from coming.
Eliyahu
HaNavi
literally Pinchas?
No, it says Pinchas didn't die. Eliyahu HaNavi didn't die, so Chazal say he's literally Pinchas. Yeah. So the answer is no. It creates a tumah if you touch the corpse.
And how would you know if you see a human bone? Mm-hmm.
Well, the halachas would apply based on the principle of majority. Meaning to say, if a majority of the people in that neighborhood are Jewish, you'd have to assume it's Jewish. If not, not. But the thing is, when you walk through a cemetery, let me explain this. When you walk through a cemetery, why are you tummy? You're not tummy because you touch the corpse is buried. But you're tummy because walking over the corpse, you become the tent. Just like, you know, when you form a tent over a corpse, right? If I'm in the same tent with a corpse, I'm tummy. Well, I myself can become that tent. In other words, if I walk over a corpse, I am tenting over the corpse and I'm tummy. That's why the same thing would be true, for example, if you have trees. See, a tent can be a building, a tent can be a tree over a corpse and you, or your own body can be the tent. Now, consequently, a Kohen is allowed to walk through a non-Jewish cemetery because the only tumah that you get in a cemetery is the tumah of being a tent over the corpse. That doesn't apply to non-Jews. Therefore, Eliyahu HaNavi will be able to go. But the point the Or HaChaim makes is, the greater the Kedusha, the greater the Tumah. Dead plants don't convey Tumah. Dead animals have somewhat of a higher soul, etc. Dead Jews are higher than dead non-Jews, etc. So consequently, the phrase, Zos Chukas HaTorah, means all of the ritual of Parah Adumah, which is because of Tumah, these laws come from the holiness that the Torah gives a Jewish life. In other words, it's not so much Parah Adumah specifically, but the whole law of Tumah comes from the Torah, comes from Kedushas HaTorah, that it is Kedushas HaTorah that sanctifies life. And because the Torah sanctifies life, when that life goes away, there is Tumah. Tumah is the void that is created. That's why all tumah is connected to death. All tumah is death. Of course, the primary source of tumah is a dead body. But even think about things like saras is a form of death. A woman is a nida. That is a form of death. Because the uterine lining, which could have sustained life for that month, is shedded. Now you may ask the kasha, the Torah says, a woman after childbirth is in a state of tumah. How could childbirth be death? Childbirth is also death. It is death of the life within. There was life within. That life is no more. There's a new life. But with respect to the person, it's an interesting irony. with respect to the person who gave birth, the life that is within is no longer there. The seminal emission for a man is considered to be tumor, because it's a form of death, potential life, the frustration of potential. So, in this sense, death comes from the potential of Kedusha. That's why we sometimes make a mistake. You sometimes see the idea, and even among Goyim there's such an idea, don't speak ill of the dead, that when someone is dead, they're entitled to kind of an extra measure of respect. Meaning, when they're alive, you could say whatever you want about them, but when they're dead, you know, don't speak ill. Now, the Emma says, you have to understand this, there is certainly a musak, a concept of kavod hames, by definition. We have to show tremendous respect to a dead body, to a corpse. But that is because the corpse is like the covering of a Sefer Torah, meaning because this was the repository of a divine soul, it is worthy of respect and honor. But that means Kavod HaMeis is to teach us a Kal V'Chomer, that if even the cover of that Neshama needs to be honored and respected, how much more so do we have to show honor and respect to people that are alive? People look at it the opposite way. They say you got to respect the dead and not the living. It's really the opposite. It's a Kal V'Chomer. Because a human soul is a Sefer Torah, and the body is the covering of the Sefer Torah. In fact, the Gemara says, Taka, that if you are in a room when somebody dies, you're not even related, you have to rip Kriya. Why? Even though you're not an Avel? Because it's like seeing a Sefer Torah burning. If Chas V'Shalom, somebody sees a Sefer Torah burning, everybody has to rip Kriya. The soul leaving the body is the Sefer Torah, as it were, being not destroyed because it goes up to Shemayim, but it's somewhat like the Sefer Torah of Hananiah ben Tarajah that he saw. He said the parchment is burning and the letters are going up with Shemayim. That's what the Neshama is. So that's the Aruch Chaim's answer, that Tuma comes from Kedusha, Zos Chukas HaTorah. There's another answer that's based on a comment of the Vilna Gaon. Again, Zos Chukas HaTorah. And the Vilna Gaon doesn't say it on this question, but they use the thought. The Vilna Gaon says, we know Torah is compared to water. Torah nimshelas lamayim. And there are a lot of reasons. Why is Torah compared to water? Just like water goes from a high ground to a low ground, the Torah leaves the high people, the arrogant people, and goes to the modest people. But the Gra says another word. The Gra says, you know why Torah is compared to water? He says that just like when you put water on ground, whatever the ground is prepared to grow, the water will accentuate. So if you planted tomatoes, the water will help tomatoes grow. If there are poisonous weeds, the water will make the weeds grow. The Gra says, Torah accentuates, brings out, and develops whatever midos a person has inculcated in themselves. That's an amazing thought. Meaning, if the person has developed compassion, kindness, and humility, the learning of the Torah will give him more compassion, will deepen his compassion, his kindness, and humility. Well, that sounds clear, but the other point is not so obvious, he says. If the person is selfish, competitive, and arrogant, the learning of the Torah will increase his selfishness and arrogance. Because it will give him... Well, this is an interesting point. It will give him another forum in which that competitiveness and self-aggrandizement can be manifest. Now, this comment of the Gra is not a universally accepted idea, but it goes back, really, it's often said, and I think this is a very clear proof, that the Vilna Gaon is the spiritual... Of course, the Vilna Gaon was not a person who demeaned the learning of Torah. We know this. The Vilna Gaon, through much of his life, learned Torah for 22 hours a day. It wasn't his schedule all of his life, because he had to, but for many, many years, he would sleep in four increments of 1 half-hour each. Never more than 1/2 hour at a time. He would eat 2 kazesim of bread a day. And, you know, I guess there was davening, other things, but 22 hours, in fact, they tell a story. What's the story? I mean, he was such a... To have the Vilagon in your city was such an honor that they say in one city, you know, when he was traveling, when he was younger, also, what he would go into self-imposed gullus. He would go from city to city when he was younger. He felt it would be a kapara. But in one city, he would be learning all night, and people would be, you know, watching him, etc. They say that in one city, he once slept 15 minutes. He slept 5 extra minutes. And he was woken up, he was crying, and, you know, he just, his whole life he referred to that city as, you know, this is the city which caused me to be nichshel, you know. But apparently years later, he came back to the city, and he only slept for 5 minutes. So he said that he made it up, he made up the time. But
that's really troubling, though, because, yeah. I mean, is there no any way that he allows for Torah to be people?
No, let me explain what the Vilna Gaon is.
Yeah,
let me explain what the Vilna Gaon is making. So now the point is, though, it is said that, you know, the Musar movement man was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter did not live in the life of the Vilna Gaon. Yisrael Salanter lived. The Vilna Gaon died in the beginning of the 1800s, and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was born around 1830. So he knew, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter knew Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. But Rabbi Yisrael Salanter developed the idea that learning Torah was not enough. At least learning, you know, conventional Torah was not enough. One had to consciously develop plans for working on midas. Now, of course, that itself involves learning Torah, but it would mean, you know, you'd have to learn the various Mamari Chazal about anger, about chesed, and their whole techniques. Now, today, every yeshiva has, you know, 20 minutes a day where you learn Musar, but that's not really what Rabbi Salanter envisioned. He envisioned a much more ambitious idea where people might spend an hour or 2 hours, and people might repeat, there were even techniques, a person might repeat a Maimer Chazal that says, you know, anyone that gets angry, kol ha-koes, kol mine gehenim sholtibo, like Chazal say, one who gets angry will be subjected to all types of gehenim. So you'd say that Maimer Chazal, you know, 1,000 times in an hour, you just say it over and over and over again, because the concept was that there are things we understand in our minds that don't really influence our behavior, unless we kind of go over it again and again. And there were different schools of Musar. His Talmidim were very different. The Altar of Slobodka was one Talmud, the Altar of Kelim, the Altar of Navardik, very, very different shitas. The Altar of Slobodka, who of course was such a tremendous influence on Rosh Shiva Zatzal, who's very, very beloved, Yerachov Kamenetsky, Rav Flitner, Rav Aaron, many, many Gedolim who came to America were very close to the Altar of Slobodka, stressed the concept of people recognizing their greatness, their godless. That was the Shita, godless Ha'adam, recognizing that if a person knows their greatness, that could allow them to accomplish. That's why Slobodka produced so many Gedolim and so many Apikorsim. Meaning to say, in Slobodka, the Shita was to find your own way, to discover yourself as an individual, to become the unique person that you are. So for those who took it the right way, they became Gedolei Torah. Some kind of took the message but distorted it, and they went on to their own way. In other words, Slobodka was very much individual. They weren't the same. Nobody came up. And I have to say that Ner Yisrael, I mean, not on the Epicurus part, but Ner Yisrael, help, the Ner Yisrael does have that sheet. You know, unlike to this very day, well, it's a little different than it used to be, but, you know, people used to say you could always know if somebody came from Philadelphia or Tells. There was a certain conformity in behavior, a certain shita. And Ner Yisrael was often criticized that there was not one particular way people behaved. But this came from Rosh Shiva Zatzal, which in turn came from the Altar of Slobodka, in which people were encouraged to develop their individuality, with the recognition that that can sometimes cause a lot of problems, because the way a person turns out is less predictable, perhaps, than it might be in other systems. The Altar of Kelim was a little bit the opposite. The Altar of Kelim was extremely into the concept of Seder, of regularity, of consistency.
And Tells, too?
And Tells was very strongly influenced by Kelim. Tells and Kelim is near each other. Navardic, you might call, it's speak somewhat irreverently, you might call the lunatic fringe of the Muslim movement. I say that irreverently, but it's very, very true. Navardic believed that a person needs to go to extremes to eradicate their gaiva, or their bad midas. If a person had a tendency, like the Rambam writes, based on the Rambam's idea, that if there's a fear that you're veering to an extreme, like a tree, you have to go to the other extreme. So in the Vardic, if someone got packages from their parents, clothes or food, they were obligated to distribute it with everybody. In other words, they couldn't even take. So they shouldn't become possessive or selfish. People had to go into stores, into grocery stores, and ask for nails or tools. In other words, even they look stupid, because that is the only way you would eradicate gaiva within your heart. Now again, the Vardic in particular was very, very controversial. I mean, there were some Gedolim who felt that it's a Chilul Hashem to give the image of these crazy people. But still, the Alter of Navardic felt it was such a shita. And the Alter of Navardic's point was that when you develop the capacity to put yourself in any situation, no matter how embarrassing, no matter how humiliating, and no matter how dangerous, you will have the koach to be omate in any type of nisayan. And that is very, very true, that during the years of Stalinist Russia, when it was dangerous. I mean, you know, if you teach Torah Barabim, you could be killed or sent to Siberia. The two institutions that remained in Stalinist Russia surreptitiously were Lubavitch. Chabad did tremendous things, and Navardic. And even the Chafetz Chaim, like, left Russia at that time. And the Alter basically said that, you know, he wanted his Talmidim to have the capacity not to fear, not to be embarrassed, not to be afraid. And he had sometimes bizarre ways of doing it, but that gave them that particular color. And again, there's Navardic yeshiva today, but again, things get toned down, you know. Things get toned down.
What is the successor of Navardic?
It's called Navardic, Beis Yosef. Yeah, no, there is a Navardic yeshiva. There are some old Navardikers. In fact, Rav Gershon Liebman, who was head of Navardic in France, was just Nifter last year. And he was kind of the remnant of the old Navardiker. And they have in Borough Park, they have Yerushalayim, and they have in France, a big yeshiva in France. They're called Beis Yosef. The Alter of Navardic thing was Yosef.
So the core, the premise, though, is not so much what I know is understood is to go into the department stores and ask for nails, right, to eradicate, you know, guidance,
yeah,
but more to build up a core of who you are that's totally independent upon what other people think of you.
Well, that's both of it. In other words, it's both to kind of eliminate the gaiva, but also to give you the strength to do what needs to be done. In fact, the Alter had the famous saying that never ask, can something be done? You just ask, you know, must it be done? If it must be done, then it can be done. Meaning to say, there was no such thing as the concept of impossibility. You ask yourself, should this be done? And then you do it. And he says, things happen, you know.
Did you
believe? No, I'm not Israel.
You were?
Yeah, I'm not Israel. Yeah, I'm not Navardic. But the point is, with Navardic, and again, with Navardic, there are just very strange things. Sometimes, you know, we look at them and, you know, it doesn't make sense to us. Like, they had a shita. Rav Gershon Liebman, for example, would never come to a place with any money. Firstly, he hated money. When you gave him money, like, he would start vomiting, and it really hit. So this whole reaction, I mean, he was a fundraiser. You know? I mean, he's collecting. He would have to go to people, because he always went with somebody. He would go to collect money. He was a yeshiva. And he went to somebody in France, and he went to a fancy house, and the person was very generous about stuff. So he gave him like $10,000 or whatever, Frank. So Gershon Liebman started vomiting. He couldn't control himself. He started retching. He had to run out of the house. So, you know, fortunately, his apprentice came back to pick up. You know, it was really that very, very visceral. And when he would travel anywhere, to America or whatever it is, he would not take any money with him. And, you know, how would he get? He didn't have money for the subway, you know. But somehow, he wouldn't even tell people he was coming. But he says, I'm on a shalichas of mitzvah, and Hashem will take care of me. And obviously, he bumped into somebody, this and that, you know. But he wouldn't even make. Again, these are levels that we don't fully understand.
They're not mutually exclusive, then, yeah. These three altars. I mean, if they're all coming from Yisrael Kalantra, then in some way they all.
Well, they're all taking, you know, the idea of Tikkun Hamidos, etc., but they emphasize different aspects. And as I said, the Vardik was very, very controversial. And
he's
some people...
To, I heard a woman speak, his husband was he's like going to the woods for like 30 days or something like
that. Well, the author of the Vardik himself was younger than the other two elders. In fact, the Emma says, the altar of Kelim was actually the closest to Yisrael Salanter. And the altar of Slobodka actually learned by the altar of Kelim. The altar of Nevardik also did, but they developed very, very different shitas.
The word altar, that does refer to the fact that he was the head of it, like the Rosh Yeshiva?
No, because he wasn't. The altar of Slobodka was not the Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka.
No, okay.
He was called the old man. It was a term of affection. He was the spiritual mentor. He was not the Rosh Yeshiva official. The Rosh Yeshiva official was much more Epstein or Israel Zalman Meltzer. But the altar was the spiritual presence. In fact, he didn't want... The altar of Slobodka, it's very interesting. His name was Nasan Svi Finkel. And if you reverse the letters, it's Safa. He used to like signing his name Safa, which is Svi Finkel Nasan. And Safa means the concealed one. He used to like... He was behind the scenes. He didn't like any type of Pearson usually. But his sefer is called Or Hatzafa, the hidden light. But the Or, no, the Nasan Svi Finkel. But the thing is that the altar of the Vardik was a balabas. He was a businessman for a number of years. And he only met Rav Yisrael Salanter once, the story goes. And Rav Yisrael Salanter asked him, you know, what do you do? So the altar said, well, I'm a businessman. And he says, why don't you spend more time in Torah? And he said, well, I have to make a living. I'm worried about living. So Rav Yisrael Salanter says, why aren't you worried about dying? And apparently it shows that that single interchange was one of those moments of transformation where he immediately just quit his business in the middle. And I don't know if he even told his family, and he went off, he became a hermit in the forest for around 10 years. And he was called Baal HaChorim, the one of the holes, because he had two holes in his door, one for Milfix, one for Fleischix. So he would just know what he was given. And the Rebbe of Nevardik at that time was a great gadol. The Rebbe of Nevardik was the Orech HaShulchan, who was one of the great, great poskim. The Orech HaShulchan was the Rebbe of the city of Nevardik.
But he wasn't the
Altar. No. He was the Rebbe of the city of Nevardik. And many people thought that the Altar of Nevardik, or Rav Yisrael as he was called, was crazy. And we ought to force him to get out of his self-imposed isolation. But the Orech HaShulchan said, you know, let him be. And later he started 132 yeshivas in Poland and in Russia. So this is what I'm trying to remember how we got onto this. Oh yeah, I just want to finish my point, then I'll be happy to talk about the Muslim movement more biarichos. The point is that these were different Talmidim of Rav Salanter, directly or indirectly, the Kelm Shita, the Slobodka Shita, the Nevardik Shita, but of course I mentioned this before, the Mesil Shasharim points out much earlier. See, the Musar Svarim, the classic Musar Svarim, do not date from Rav Yisrael Salanter's times. All of them are much older. Sha'arei Tshuva of Rabbeinu Yona goes back to the time of the Rishonim. It goes back to the 1200s. Mesilas Yesharim, it goes to the 1700s, right? So the Muslim movement was not mechadesh, the concept of books that deal with character. What about Chazal? Mamore Chazal are full of the importance of Midas. But there's the concept of making it really part of the curriculum in a very intense way, not just 20 minutes away, but part of the yeshiva curriculum. And in fact, there were special houses of Musar. Yerushalayim still has one base Musar, where you go and kind of just concentrate on Musar. You would cry, you'd speak to Hashem. A lot of it actually drew on some Hasidic practices as well, like Breslov has what is called hispodidus, where you go off by yourself. So that was taken by the Bali Musar. In fact, the Altar of Nevardik had very close affinity to Breslov. A lot of the practices are, although they're different movements, but a lot of the practices are very much the same. Well, they're extreme, but there's a recognition that life is a war. They took very seriously the Mesilas Yesharim's point, where he says, life is a war.
War?
War. Yeah. There is so much out there that can take a person away from Avodas Hashem, so much that can destroy you spiritually. And when you're fighting a war, you got to sometimes take extreme measures. There really was that idea of we're fighting a war. And we need our strength. We need to do whatever needs to be done to fight that war. Olam HaZeh, they were living in Stalinist Russia, etc. But Olam HaZeh generally is a war, it's a struggle. And we need both our physical ways of combating it, and we need mental ways. We have to think about strategies and everything else. But the point I want to make is that when we saw Salanter's idea of institutionalizing Musar, which seems like a benign or logical idea, actually had some opposition among great Gedolim. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was against it, for example. In fact, even Slobodka, the great Slobodka Yeshiva, when the Alter wanted to start Musar, he really had to break away. There had been a yeshiva in Slobodka, but it was against the idea of Musar. And therefore, there were two great yeshivas in Slobodka. One did Musar, one didn't do Musar. And it was felt that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik basically said, Torah itself heals the soul. Learning Torah is masaking. It elevates a person. It sanctifies a person. But the Chafetz Chaim, who is a great supporter of Musar, said that any yeshiva in which does not concentrate on Musar, he described it as a bor b'rishus haravim. It's like digging a pit in a public road, meaning to say, people think, you know, the road is good. Let's imagine you're driving on a highway which has a huge pothole, and they don't warn you about it. You think the road is good, you're going to destroy your car. And Chafetz Chaim's point was, and Yisrael said this as well, he said that Torah is the diet for a healthy soul. When a soul is healthy, the Torah gives that soul all the nutrition that it needs. But when the soul is sick and the soul is imbalanced, there needs to be special medication. Is a need for a conscious emphasis on character and midos. Now, I would suggest that indeed this is exactly what is borne out by the Vilna Gaon's comments. That Torah itself, according to this idea, is not misaking midos alone, but rather one needs to take the medicine of consciously working on midos. And then the Torah will strengthen the soul and fortify it. But otherwise, Torah is compared to water. And I guess the Chiddush of the Vilna...
Did he say anything like that explicitly about the Gra? If you do have these characteristics, what do you do?
No. The Vilna Gaon talks about learning Musar. But again, as I say, he didn't talk about it in terms of a curriculum or anything else. You know, every person should spend a certain amount of time.
But what should you do? It's so devastating what he says,
Tikkun Hamidos.
But that inside you, this Torah is just going to...
Well, that's the avoda of Tikkun Hamidos, to consciously rectify one's midos by working on it, by exercises. They're exercises, as it were. 20 minutes a day, I'm not going to get angry. You know, there are different things that you do.
The
Vilna Gaon talks about the exercises of midos. So the Emma says a lot of Yisrael Salanter's program finds its seeds in the Vilna Gaon's writings. In fact, the Vilna Gaon's Talmud is Rav Chaim Volozhiner, and Rav Chaim of Volozhin's Talmud was Rav Zundel of Salant. And Rav Zundel of Salant was Rav Yisrael Salanter's, same city, Yisrael Salanter's Rebbe. So Yisrael Salanter is a fourth generation from the Vilna Gaon in that sense. Now again, though, this is a very, very interesting point because, in effect, it bridges the gap to some degree between Hasidim and Misnagdim, because the early opposition to Hasidus was that there was too much emphasis on not just learning, but on consciously thinking about Avodas Hashem and the emotional state. On the other hand, the Yisrael Salanter was saying we have to think about that as well, but in terms of Tikkun Hamidos and everything else. So that's what the Vilna. So going back to the interpretive issue, some want to use this Vilna Gaon to explain. That's why it says Zos Chukas HaTorah. What do we mean? What is the inexplicable law of the Parah Aduma? The inexplicable law of the Parah Aduma is mitaher es hatmeim umitamei es hatahorim. What does it mean? It purifies those who are ritually impure. If I'm Tameh, a little sprinkling of the water and the ashes makes me Tohar. But the paradox is that the Tohar person who touches the ashes and water becomes Tameh. Let me just explain that halakha, because people often don't have a clear picture of what that means. The Torah itself says that the Kohen who slaughters the Parah and burns it down to ashes becomes Tameh. Now, you're only Tameh for one day. You're not Tameh for 7 days, and you don't need to be sprinkled with the ashes of the Parah Aduma, but you are Tameh for one day. The Kohen who gathers the ashes together is Tameh for one day. The Kohen who carries the ashes away from the site is Tameh for one day. Now, one thing is a little misleading. The Torah seems to say that the Kohen who sprinkles the person each morning becomes Tameh. That's what it says. But Rashi says that's not actually true. The Kohen who sprinkles you is not Tameh, but the Torah uses the word the sprinkler to indicate that the amount of ashes, if you carry, that makes you Tameh, is the amount that would be sprinkled. The actual mazeh is not Tameh. But be it as it may, the chok of Parah Aduma is not merely that it's a red cow, etc. The chok of the Parah Aduma is the paradox. So why does it say Zos Chukas HaTorah? Because the same paradox that's embodied in Parah is embodied in Torah. Torah can be mitaher the person, but it can also be metame the person, unless there's a conscious striving for tikkun hamidos. Now, we actually see this to some ways. I mean, again, it's still a very big machlokas in Hashkafa. The Chazon Ish, for example, was against the formal learning of Musar. Although he once said a very beautiful thing. He once said, I am opposed to the Musar movement, but I am more opposed to those who are opposed to it. Meaning to say that the Chazon Ish recognized the avoda of tikkun hamidos. He just felt that certain things didn't have to be institutionalized in the yeshiva curriculum. But many of those who were opposed to Musar weren't taking the idea of midos very seriously. You know, but the truth of the matter is we do see that in many, many cases, the Baal Gaiva, particularly in Gaiva, maybe it's harder to see in other midos, but the Baal Gaiva will become more of a Baal Gaiva in many cases. It's another area to show off. One who puts down other people will have another avenue to put them down. Again, even buying Sfarim, this is, I have to say, it's my, I have, but even buying Sfarim can be an expression of acquisitiveness. It may come from a Yetzirah. You acquire. So some people will acquire this and that, and one of people who acquire, you know, even Sfarim can be a matter of acquisitiveness, which one should control.
Well, in one case, he produced an acher, so it could destroy a person that way.
Well, the Elisha ben Avoya learned a lot of Torah, right? So there has to be a conscious striving. Now, Rav Chaim Volozhiner in Nefesh HaChaim, again, before Rav Yisrael Salanter, gives an interesting analogy. He says that we find, the Gemara says, actually, this was said at the Bina graduation by one of the rabbis, the Gemara in Shabbos, that talks about Yiras Hashem Otsaro. Yiras Hashem is the storehouse for the Torah within. Now, the analogy is, Yiras Hashem is that which preserves the Torah and prevents it from rotting and spoiling. So Rav Chaim Volozhiner said, the Gemara says in the Bava Metzia, it gives ratios for preserving grain. When you sell grain, how much preservative do you put into it to keep it fresh? So it mentions 1/24th of the volume that you're selling should be preservative. So Rav Chaim Volozhiner says, if Yiras Shamayim is described as the preservative, then the appropriate ratio, he says, of Musar learning, he suggests, again, the Rishon Lezion had a much longer share, but he said for a healthy person, it should be a ratio of 1/24th. So if a person learns, let's say, 12 hours a day, that's where you get the half an hour, you know, type of thing. That's the idea.
It needs guidance. You don't.
There's a big.
Without it, it's.
That's right. I mean, on one level, again, the Chazon Ish said, you know, anything in Torah you learn elevates you. On the other level, there is a concept that when a soul is sick, it needs very special and directed treatment. And, that's something that's sometimes lacking in even our education, that we don't necessarily consciously strive towards Tikkun HaMidas. And that's a very, very big avoda. The Vilna Gaon, again, remarked that to change one mida to good is harder than learning the whole Shas. Just to change one mida in a positive way. That's right. So again, I mean, everything is rooted in Chazal. I mean, so you say Rishal Salanter was Machadesh Musr. I mean, he wasn't Machadesh Musr, but the point is that he emphasized, like every authentic movement in Klal Yisrael is never Machadesh, right? How can you be Machadesh? What do you mean Machadesh? We didn't have it before. But different generations need different emphases. Everything is there. But at certain times in our history, certain things need to be brought to the forefront. And other times, other things are brought to the forefront. And different things are emphasized. So everything, Chassidus, everything is a question of emphasizing, taking facets and emphasizing them, rediscovering them, re-implementing them. That's what a so-called movement is. But this is what I mentioned, the Mesilas Yesharim gives a classic example of how it's so easy, as it were, to be a hypocrite in Midas. He talks about even the phenomenon of false modesty, which can even fool a person, where a person goes out of his way to be conspicuously humble all the time while taking a secret pride in how humble and modest they are. That they refuse any cover. They refuse an aliyah because they say, I don't want kavod. All the while, as it were, conscious that people are thinking, what a modest and humble person he is. And this is the classic story. I mentioned it before about the two boys in the train, where they're sitting next to each other.
Who's the worst?
And who's the worst? I'm gorgeous and I'm nothing and I'm worthless. And then they start crying and giving musr. And another man says, oh, if these B'nai Torah are nothing, I'm nothing. And they look at him and say, look who thinks he's nothing. He doesn't have the right to say he's nothing. You have to be a something to say that you're nothing. That's the Mesilas Yesharim's idea of a person taking a gaiva in their humility. In fact, often people say, what is the state of mind of an anaf? What is an anaf? Does an anaf think, I'm no good? L'chara, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Thought he was no good. Thinks he's worse than everybody. The answer is pashut. The state of mind of an anaf is, he doesn't think about it one way or the other. An anaf is not involved in consciously thinking about himself or herself. The anaf thinks about what needs to be done in the world in terms of avodas Hashem. The anaf does not think highly of himself in an arrogant way, nor does the anaf think poorly of himself. The anaf does not have himself in his head. That's all. Which is why the Mida of Anava can allow a person to take great joy in their positive achievements, but not because they did it. They take great joy because something good was done. So in other words, the true Anav, this is a very high level, gets a tremendous simcha, let's say, when they finish a Masechta, because they finished a Masechta, but they get tremendous simcha when somebody else finished a Masechta, because somebody else finished a Masechta. Meaning to say, you look not so much at what it says about you, but you look about the fact that it's done. And that's why, a person that has low self-esteem has a very strong common denominator with the person who's very arrogant, besides the fact that arrogance often comes from insecurity. And that's because everything that happens in the world is taken as a judgment on them. The arrogant person sees what happens as confirmation of how great he is, and this person lacking in self-esteem sees everything that happens as a judgment about how poor they are. The anaf is task-oriented. Therefore, the concept is l'may nafkamina. Who gets the credit? L'may nafkamina. Who did the mitzvah? The main thing is that the mitzvah was done, and we should be grateful. The Chazanish is an example. The Chazanish says, let's assume that you really want to have a guest for Shabbos. And the guest was taken already. So what are your feelings? Sometimes your feelings might be resentment, might be anger. The Chazanish says, you know, inside, I mean, you're not going to yell at somebody, but you know, you might feel, you know, shortchanged. The Chazanish says, now again, some people might argue with that, but the Chazanish writes that that means it wasn't really L'shem Shemayim. Because if Achnasas Orchim is to give a person, to be sure that a person is taken care of, and not just so you'll get the credit, as it were, of being, you know, a generous person, then it really shouldn't make a difference to you. As long as the person is well taken care of, you should be happy that the person is taken care of. It shouldn't be a question of ego gratification. And he says that's kind of a measure often. Do we do mitzvahs because of Hashem's sake things need to be done, or do mitzvahs because they give us a source of kavod? Even if it's a private kavod, you know, not necessarily a private. So he says that one has to be very, very careful in looking at their motives. No, no, of course, of course. I don't mean, listen, I mean certainly when doing mitzvahs is a wonderful thing. I mean, we're not disparaging that at all. All we're saying is that what the Baalei Mussar emphasize is the notion of part of your spiritual growth is to try to purify your motivations. And that's a very, very difficult thing. This is because Chazanish was not a Talmud of Rishon Lezion, but he also made the same point. Okay, I'm sorry, I know I came late, but I do have to leave a little early.